and gave her hope that this mausoleum would one day feel like home. When she grew bored, she grabbed Pixie's leash and a couple of her doggy toys and headed across the street to Battery Park. The days were growing shorter, and a chill had set in, the tease of a new season on the horizon. She roamed the 5-acre park, admiring the Civil War cannons and the Fort Moultrie Monument. She read the monument's inscription, "To the Defenders of Fort Moultrie." She imagined herself as a child, running barefoot in the grass, her mother sitting on a nearby park bench reading a novel. But it wasn't a memory. It was a fantasy. Had her mother been too ill to take her across the street to the park? Ellie studied with an artist's eye the light filtering in through the live oak trees. When her supplies arrived from California, she would set up her easel in the center of the park and paint the row of houses on South Battery Street. It was after 6 when she returned home. Ellie scooped a heaping spoonful of chicken salad onto a bed of leafy greens for her dinner. She poured a glass of Pinot Grigio from the bottle Maddie left chilling in the refrigerator and took her dinner to her studio. While she ate, she watched a couple of wrens through the window, splashing themselves in the concrete birdbath outside. With the beauty of the garden as a backdrop, the room offered the sense of serenity Ellie craved. She hadn't asked for the house, but now that she'd inherited it, she might as well make it her own. She finished her dinner and then took her plate back to the kitchen and poured another glass of wine. Returning to her studio, she set her glass down on the table and approached the bookcase, running her finger along the spines of the books on the bottom shelf. An hour and a half later, her wine untouched on the table, she was balancing on her tiptoes on the kitchen step stool as she reached for a leather-bound journal in the far right corner of the top shelf. She managed not to fall as she grabbed hold of the journal and climbed down from the stool. She opened the journal and read the first entry. The diary belonged to her mother. When her hand began to tremble, she closed the journal and gripped it tight to her torso. She would read it for sure, but what was she hoping to discover? The key to her past? Confirmation of her mother's love? Her grandmother's love? Although that was seeming less and less likely, and less desirable. Was she ready to finally face whatever had happened to her here? She'd tried and failed for so many years. Could she do it alone with only her grandmother's ghost to comfort her? She locked up the house and headed upstairs to her room. She was ready to move on with her life. Of that much, she was sure. But she was terrified of the experiences she might have to relive in order to do so.
Chapter 5 Ashton. I arrived home late on Saturday afternoon from the hairdresser to find James Middleton and his parents in the dining room with Mother, the silver tea service and an assortment of finger sandwiches on the table in front of them. Mother rose out of her chair to greet me.
"Come in, darling. Join us for tea," she said in a sugary sweet voice.
She's never called me darling in my life. She's mentioned James to me several times in recent weeks. She's got it in her deranged mind that we would make the perfect couple. I barely know the man. And he is a man. In his early 30s, if my memory serves me correctly. He's awkward in both appearance and behavior. He lives at home with his parents on Gibbs Street and spends his days playing chess with himself on their piazza. Mother speaks often of his high IQ, as if that's any excuse for him not to have a proper job. Mother says that James doesn't need to work.
Between your money and his, your offspring for the next 4 generations won't have to lift a finger.
Phooey on her. Everyone should work regardless of the size of their trust fund. I refuse to be defined by another human being. I have higher aspirations for myself than being Mrs. James Martin Middleton V. For the past month, after graduating from the all-women's college Mother had insisted I attend, I've been making the rounds of countless teas and luncheons hosted by Mother's friends and their daughters, many of whom were my peers at Ashley Hall, from kindergarten all the way through high school. I detest these functions. I have nothing in common with these women, my supposed friends, who seem content to live the same life they've always lived. They sound like broken records, every one of them. They talk about marrying wealthy men, having children, playing tennis, and attending more of the same boring old parties. No thank you. That is not the life for me. I can't imagine sitting around doing nothing all day. I have my future all planned out. Come hell or high water, I will go to New York and become a fashion model. One day I'll be featured in Vogue and Cosmopolitan. Last spring, while I was still at school, I spent 3 months' allowance on a professional photo shoot. I sent the headshots to a handful of modeling agencies in Manhattan, and two of them wrote back requesting interviews. I'm still working up the nerve to respond. Every day I remind myself that I'm not getting any younger. A few more years, and I'll be too old for modeling. What's holding me back then? What am I so afraid of? My mother, of course. Eleanor Pringle would never approve of her only daughter flaunting her body in front of the camera in such a tawdry way. When she finishes beating me silly with my father's jogging stick, she will cut the purse strings with a butcher knife, leaving me without a dime. As much as I loathe my privileged lifestyle, I have no clue how to function in a world without money. Where will I live if I run away to New York? Who will I live with? What will become of me if I fail? I sat at the table across from the Middletons and behaved like the young woman of proper breeding that I am. I planted a smile on my face, but I kept my mouth shut. I had nothing to contribute to the conversation. I felt James's eyes on me, but I didn't dare look at him. I stared instead at the portrait of my father above the sideboard. Edwin Pringle would have supported my decision to go to New York. God rest his soul. His was the only voice of reason I've ever known. I was only 7 when he passed away from cancer, a year after his mother died of heart failure. I loved my Grandma Amelia. She was a sweet old lady who was no match for her daughter-in-law. Mother never showed any kindness to my father or his mother, and the minute they were in the ground at Magnolia Cemetery, she turned into a tyrant. I plotted my escape while my mother gossiped with the Middletons about their mutual friends. I know the train schedule by heart, and I've put aside enough money from my allowance to live for a month without a job in New York. I'm a college graduate and grown woman of 22. I feel ridiculous sneaking out of town under the cover of darkness to get away from my mother. But I'm willing to do whatever it takes. She can't force me to marry a man I don't love. As they were leaving, James pulled me aside and asked if I would attend the 4th of July party with him at the club on Tuesday. To avoid an argument with Mother, I told him yes. But I will be long gone by then. Mother lectured me long and hard over dinner about the advantages of marrying into a wealthy family. I raked my fork through my mashed potatoes and bided my time. I excused myself from the table and went upstairs to pack my bags. I emptied the jar of cash I keep hidden beneath a loose board beside my bed into my purse. After Mother retired for the night, I called a taxi to take me to the station to catch the overnight train to New York. I arrived at Penn Station the following afternoon around 3. Remember when I went to New York with my senior class in high school? We toured the city in a bus, visiting all the local tourist attractions, and the chaperones refused us any free time to explore on our own. But this time is different. I'm all on my own with no one to guide me. When I exited Penn Station, I was overwhelmed by the hustle and bustle of the busy city streets. Unsure of what subway line to take or how to hail a cab, I joined the throng of New Yorkers hurrying along the sidewalk to their destinations. I wandered the streets until I came upon a nondescript hotel advertising vacancy. Ignoring the creepy stares of the disreputable-looking men loitering in the lobby, I booked a room for 3 nights and took the elevator to the 5th floor. My room has a full-size bed with a floral print polyester bedspread, orange wall-to-wall shag carpet with stains from liquids I can't bring myself to think about, and one window with a view of the building next door. I don't mind the squalid interior so much. The room represents freedom for me. I went to the diner across the street for dinner. I ordered the blue plate special, fried chicken and biscuits smothered in butter. But the butterflies fluttering around in my belly prevented me from taking more than a few bites. I woke early enough to shampoo and blow-dry my thick hair. I chose a simple black sleeveless dress and matching patent pumps from the meager wardrobe I brought with me. I exited the revolving doors in the lobby of the hotel, and following the lead of the gentleman standing next to me, I raised my hand in the air to summon a taxi. The driver took me to the address I provided, an impressive stone office building on 5th Avenue. At the modeling agency on the 3rd floor, I gave the receptionist the fake name I'd submitted with my photographs last spring. I'm now known to the world as Nettie Pearson. I want to start a new life with no strings attached to my mother or to Charleston. Creating a new identity for myself seems like a good way to go about doing that. The matronly receptionist stared down her nose at me and asked if I had an appointment. Not exactly, but I have this. I slid an envelope across the desk to the woman and explained that I had submitted my photos to their agency and received a request for an interview in response. I hadn't planned to be in New York today, but since I'm here, I thought I'd stop by on the off chance Mrs. Porter could see me. The woman skimmed the letter, returned it to the envelope, and handed it back to me. She swept her hand in the direction of the adjoining waiting room and told me to have a seat. The room was already packed with stunning beauties in all shapes, sizes, and genders. I experienced a sinking feeling in the pit of my gut as I made my way to the one available chair in the far corner of the room. A sheltered southern girl like myself doesn't stand a chance against these sophisticated beings. The teenage girl to my right, with vacant eyes and hollowed-out cheeks, ignored me. But the young woman on my left, who appeared to be about my age, started jabbering away the minute I sat down. "I don't know why I waste my time coming to these interviews," she said. "Even if I lost 20 pounds, they'd never pick me over someone like you. You're gorgeous. Simply gorgeous. I would kill to have hair this strawberry blonde color." She fingered a lock of my hair, a gesture I would normally find offensive from a total stranger. But this girl's pert nose, bouncing white curls, and twinkling blue eyes made me feel at ease. She introduced herself as Louisa Whitehead. I started to give her my name, but caught myself. "I'm Nettie Pearson." The name sounded foreign and mysterious on my tongue, like I'm a Cold War spy. "Say." Louisa touched the tip of her finger to the dimple in her chin as she studied me. "I don't think I've seen you around before. You must be new in town. Are you by any chance in need of a place to live? Because I'm looking for a roommate. My last roommate gave up on her modeling career and moved back home to Ohio. I can afford the rent even if I never land a modeling gig. I have a full-time job at an advertising agency. I live with 2 other girls in a 2-bedroom apartment in the village. You would share the other twin bed in my room. You'd have the room to yourself most nights. I have a boyfriend. At least for the moment. I'm not sure how much longer we'll be together. He's nice enough, but he's not exactly the marrying type. Not that I want to get married anytime soon. I'd rather be single than waste my time on a relationship with no future." Louisa talked so much I was worn out from listening to her. I can barely remember what she said, but I liked her just the same. I've never met anyone quite like Louisa, so open and energetic. I asked her why she was interviewing at a modeling agency when she already has a career. It's not a career per se. I'm a secretary. I'm only 23. I'm not ready to give up on my dreams quite yet. Louisa dug her fingers into my arm. I know what you're thinking. What's she doing playing hooky from her paying job to come here? Don't worry. I don't miss work very often. I rarely get called back for interviews. She paused to take a breath. So, are you interested? In looking at the apartment, I mean. She rummaged in her bag for a scrap of paper and jotted down her address. Why don't you stop by around 6 tonight? It won't hurt to take a look. I took the number from her and folded it into my bag. What did I have to lose? I have nowhere else to live. For the next few minutes, Louisa spoke about the apartment and all the benefits of living in Greenwich Village. I was so mesmerized by her talk of life in the Big Apple, I failed to respond when the receptionist summoned Nettie Pearson. Louisa elbowed me in the side. She's calling your name ahead of everyone else. That's a good sign. With a quick glance around the room, I noticed all eyes were on me. I don't understand. I was the last to arrive. But you're the prettiest one in the room. That's how these things work. She nudged me out of my seat. Go. Good luck, and I'll see you tonight at 6. I followed the receptionist down a long, narrow hall into a large office with a bank of windows overlooking Fifth Avenue. A rectangular table was positioned in front of the windows, behind which sat a young man wearing a black beret and an imposing figure I recognized right away as Olga Porter. She came from behind the table to greet me. Dressed in Chanel with her black hair piled atop her head, she was every bit as elegant in person as she was in the photographs of her featured regularly in magazines and on the news. She circled me, scrutinizing me from head to toe.
You're lovely, dear. Very wholesome. Have you done any modeling?
No, ma'am, I answered. Olga raised a pencil-thin eyebrow.
Beauty pageants?
I shook my head. Olga brushed an invisible speck of lint off her Chanel suit as if brushing away a fly.
So, you're just another Cheryl Teagues wannabe from Minnesota?
Despite the churning in my stomach, I looked Olga in the eye and held her gaze. I'm not from the Midwest. I'm from the South.
That makes a difference, then. Did you hear that, Abbott?
Olga turned to the young man sitting behind the desk.
We have ourselves another Scarlett O'Hara wannabe.
Her attempt at a southern accent failed. Abbott got out of his chair and approached me. Lifting my chin, he rotated my head one way and then another.
She has good bones. Why don't we see what the camera thinks?
Olga peered at me over Abbott's shoulder.
I don't see it, but you're the genius. Go, take your photographs.
She shooed us off toward a side door.
But don't waste too much time on her. We have a waiting room full of wannabe somebodies today.
Abbott led me into his studio in the adjoining room. Closing the door behind us, he pointed to a bench in the corner.
You can put your things over there. You might feel more comfortable if you take off your shoes.
I dropped my bag on the bench, slipped off my shoes, and went to stand in front of his camera. I felt awkward at first, but Abbott's warm chocolate eyes, gentle smile, and soft voice instructing me on how to position my body and where to direct my eyes set me at ease. He's attractive despite his hawkish nose, which I think adds character to his otherwise ordinary face. When he finished shooting, he asked me if I had time to wait for his assistant to develop the proof sheets. I smiled at him and told him, of course. I was willing to wait all day for a chance at a job. Louisa had already left when I returned to our corner of the waiting room. I thumbed through magazines while I monitored the comings and goings of the wannabe somebodies in the room. One by one, they were summoned for their audience with Olga, and one by one, they exited her office. Most wore dejected faces, but one lucky lovely was given a clipboard with forms to fill out. I hadn't considered the application, the challenges ahead of living under an assumed name. If I'm fortunate enough to be offered the job, I'll speak confidentially to someone in the personnel department, explaining my need to protect my family's privacy. Fabricating a little white lie will add legitimacy to my claim. I'll tell them my mother is mentally ill. That should do the trick. A talent agency will certainly want to keep that skeleton in the closet. My stomach rumbled for a stretch around lunchtime, but the hunger pangs eventually subsided. The last interviewee left around 4, and I was beginning to think Abbott had forgotten about me, when he finally emerged from the back.
We are ready for you now.
He took me by the hand and helped me out of my chair.
Fasten your seatbelt, Miss Pearson. I'm about to make you a superstar.
Chapter 6. Ellie. Ellie lay her mother's open journal face down on her stomach. Her eyes were tired from deciphering Ashton's messy handwriting. Staring up at the paint peeling off the ceiling, she tried to process the new information she'd learned about her mother. Growing up, she'd constantly peppered her father with questions about her mother. He usually responded with a brusque, "What's in the past is best left in the past." As for her last name being different from his, she didn't want to share the hall bathroom with her stepmother and 2 bratty half-brothers, let alone her last name. As a nature photographer, her father was gone for weeks, sometimes months at a time, traveling into the wild and remote parts of the world. His income afforded them a comfortable living without any extras. In the absence of a housekeeper or someone to help in the yard, her stepmother gave Ellie more than her share of the chores. On top of doing the laundry, cleaning the bathrooms, and mowing the grass, she babysat for her little brothers night after night while her stepmother went down the street to drink wine with her neighbor. Jenny barked orders at her, and she screamed at her when she left her wet towel on the floor of the bathroom or when she forgot to take out the trash. But she never had a conversation with Ellie. She never took her shopping, attended school events, or expressed an interest in any of her friends. The teenage years were the hardest, when Ellie's hormones raged inside her. She longed for a maternal figure that she could share her confusing emotions with. She'd yearned for a mother who understood her and truly cared about her. Instead, she was left with Jenny, who never taught her to use a tampon or talked to her about where babies came from, never offered advice about boys or college or her future. Late one night, shortly after her 16th birthday, Ellie and her father were spooning cookie dough ice cream out of the carton at the kitchen table when she broached the subject of her mother for the umpteenth time. "Did my mother like to eat ice cream late at night like we do?" Her father smiled into the carton.
"Not ice cream, no. Ashton didn't have much of a sweet tooth. She liked to eat leftover Chinese food out of the carton at midnight."
She'd never heard him refer to her mother by name before, and the soft expression on his face gave her hope that he'd once loved Ashton. Abbott took Ellie to see a child psychiatrist once a week when she first came to live with him, but after a couple of years when money grew tight and the therapy didn't appear to be working, they stopped going, and he stopped talking about her past altogether. In his mind, she sensed, not talking about it would make it go away. Ellie sought therapy again during her freshman year in college, when the demons that haunted her drove her to experiment with drugs. The therapist helped her to stop abusing drugs and control her alcohol usage, and she'd been seeing Patsy once a week ever since. When Bennett Calhoun contacted her with news of her grandmother's death, Ellie phoned her father to tell him about her inheritance. He'd long since divorced Jenny and was working for National Geographic in Washington, D.C.
"You're a grown woman, Ellie. I can't tell you what to do, but you're liable to wake up a few sleeping dogs by going down to Charleston. And I think it's best to let them lie. I'm going, Dad, and you can't stop me. All my life, you refused to talk to me about my family. Are you hiding something from me? Because if there's anything you want me to know, now would be a good time to tell me before I find out on my own. Her father had sighed heavily into the phone. I haven't been hiding anything from you, sweetheart. I've been protecting you. You were a terrified little girl when you came to live with me. I held you at night when you cried out in your sleep. I saw with my own eyes how difficult it was for you to adjust to your new environment. I sensed that something very bad happened to you in Charleston. Whatever that thing is buried so deep inside of you, your therapist couldn't reach it after years of trying. Bottom line, Ellie, I don't want to see you get hurt. I understand how you feel, Dad. But I'll never be able to lead a normal life until I figure out what that thing is. Ellie heard a rattling engine and squeaky brakes out in front of her house. She threw back the covers and hurried over to the window. Her moving truck had arrived 4 hours early and was attempting to parallel park on the street. She brushed her teeth and, ignoring the rat's nest of hair at the crown of her head, changed into a pair of pink overall shorts and a white tee. She dashed down the stairs, noticing as she passed her grandmother's bedroom that the door was once again closed. No matter how many times she opened it, the door somehow managed to close itself again. The movers were already unloading her things and placing them about the yard. She went out to greet them. The crew leader tipped his hat at her.
"Morning, ma'am. If you'll tell us where to put everything, we'll get started bringing it all inside."
Shielding her eyes from the sun, she stared up at the man whose shoulders were as broad as her front porch. She stifled a smile when she imagined him lifting his moving truck with a single hand. That's a good question. As excited as she'd been for her things to arrive, Ellie had given little consideration to where she would store the things she didn't need. She noticed her housekeeper observing them from the porch.
"Maddie, is there any room in the attic for some of this stuff?"
She'd abandoned her tour of the upstairs after she'd gotten locked in her grandmother's bedroom.
"Lord, yes, there's plenty of room. Your attic runs from one end of the house to the other. It's easy to get up there, too."
Ellie turned back to the monster mover. "Let's put the bed and mattress and this chest." She ran her hand across the dresser she'd used in her bedroom in San Francisco. "In the attic. The rest of the furniture will go in the sunroom at the back of the house. The wardrobes go upstairs in my room. It's the corner front bedroom, first door on the left at the top of the stairs." With Maddie leading the way, Ellie and the movers paraded into the house and up two flights of stairs to the attic. Buckets in every shape and size were scattered about under the eaves at the front of the house.
"What's all this?" Ellie asked Maddie.
"The roof leaks," Maddie said. "Didn't the roofing man tell you that when he was here?"
"He mentioned that the roof had leaks, but I never envisioned it being this bad. No wonder his proposal was so high. Did my grandmother know about this?"
"Yes'm. She made me move everything out of the way so it wouldn't get wet."
Maddie gestured at the odd assortment of furniture and lamps, cardboard boxes and steamer trunks, fans and garment racks lined with old ball gowns pushed to the back of the attic. Ellie shook her head.
"I can't believe she was too cheap to have the roof fixed."
"Your grandma was 95 years old, Miss Ellie. She wasn't interested in much of anything, least of all fixing things that were broke. Instead, she left this mess for me," Ellie thought to herself.
For the rest of the morning, Ellie supervised the movers, instructing them on where to place her things throughout the house. She dug through the boxes marked kitchen for her microwave, Keurig, electric corkscrew, and stemless wine glasses. She positioned her upholstered furniture, all covered in textured fabrics and shades of pale gray, to take advantage of the view of the garden,
with the back of the sofa facing the hallway and the two club chairs in front of the bookcases. Her sisal rug covered most of the floor, with the exception of several feet at the end of the room where her grandmother's portrait once hung. The space was a perfect place to set up her easels. She put her Lucite desk behind the sofa and replaced the card table with her antique walnut table and four chairs, items she'd purchased years ago with proceeds from the sale of her first painting. When the monster mover brought in her computer monitor and flat-screen television, she made a mental note to call the cable and internet provider. Late that afternoon, as she and Maddie stood admiring her new studio, Ellie said, "I understand why a 95-year-old woman wouldn't have Wi-Fi, but I'm surprised there's no TV in the house. I've been so busy I didn't realize it until today."
"Your grandma didn't approve of television."
"Well, that's gonna change, but not until Wednesday of next week. That's the earliest Verizon can come. I don't watch much TV, but I like to have at least one in the house for special news and sporting events."
"Put one in the kitchen, and I might sneak a peek at my stories while I'm doing the ironing."
Maddie let out a cackle that made Ellie smile. "Consider it done," Ellie said. "You deserve to watch your stories after all these years."
"Want me to bring a painting from one of the other rooms to cover that up?"
Ellie followed her gaze to the white rectangle on the far wall where her grandmother's portrait once hung. "Don't you dare. I have big plans for that wall." First thing on Thursday morning, Ellie drove her rental car to Lowe's in West Ashley for supplies. She found a stepladder in the corner of the detached garage out back and positioned it in front of the wall. She then rolled the entire wall in dove gray and waited for that to dry. She spent the afternoon creating an abstract mural by splattering paint in shades of charcoal and white and several hues of pink that matched the decorative pillows on her sofa, in an organized fashion all over the wall. She put her supplies away, tidied up the room, and stretched out on the sofa to admire her work. She'd transformed her grandmother's shabby Florida room into a comfortable studio that was beginning to feel the tiniest bit like home. "One room down, Pix. A whole house full of rooms to go." Pixie looked up at her, thumping her tail on her pink doggy bed. Suddenly overwhelmed, Ellie scooped the dog up and held her tight to her body. "We're out of our league here, you know. We have enough money to live anywhere in the world we'd like. We could go someplace exotic, a city or island or countryside, where I'll never run out of scenes to paint, and you'll never run out of places to explore." Her eyes came into contact with the floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. "But first, I need to find the answers I'm looking for." She jumped up. "It's gotta be here somewhere." One by one, she removed the books from the shelves, studying each one carefully for clues, a newspaper clipping or photograph or pressed corsage from a long-ago dance. She found nothing. Not even a church bulletin from her grandfather's funeral. Chapter 7. Ellie. Bennett's wife, Lucille, invited Ellie to go for coffee on Friday morning. "Black tap coffee caters to the college crowd," Lucille had said on the phone. "But the coffee's the best in town." The quaint coffee shop was located on Bufane Street, a 7-minute bike ride from home. Ellie had been thrilled to see her vintage bicycle complete with front basket being unloaded from the moving truck. Considering the congestion problem in Charleston, she suspected that two wheels might be the easiest and fastest way to explore downtown without having to navigate traffic or worry about finding a place to park. Lucille was waiting for her at a table by the window. She was the picture of casual elegance, with her sleek, silvery blonde bob tucked behind her ears and the tanned skin on her face pulled pulled tight over prominent cheekbones by an expert. They went to the counter together to order. Ellie requested the latte with homemade lavender syrup and a pastry, while Lucille asked for the Guatemalan brew. After questioning her about her work for a few minutes, Lucille asked, "How is it that a lovely young woman such as yourself never married?" Normally, Ellie would have been bothered by such a personal question, and especially from someone she'd just met. But Lucille asked in a manner of genuine interest. "I just never met the right man," Ellie said with a shrug. "My one regret is not having children." "Have you looked around lately?" Lucille waved her bony hand at the nearly empty coffee shop. "Women your age are giving birth every day. I have a friend whose daughter recently gave birth to triplets at age 50. That's a drawback, of course. The older you are, the more likely you'll need to resort to a fertility treatment, which increases your chances of having more than one baby. I'm sure I don't need to tell you this." "I should probably find the daddy for my baby first," Ellie said as she sipped her latte. "Now that I can help you with." Lucille slid back in her chair and crossed her legs. "We'll get started right away introducing you around town. Bennett and I are attending a gallery showing tonight. You must come with us. I know nothing about the artist. I'm going as a favor to the gallery owner, who is an acquaintance of mine." Ellie opened her mouth to decline the invitation. She was not yet ready to meet Charleston's elite, the offspring of ancestors who were among the soldiers that fired their cannons from Fort Sumter. But Lucille didn't give her a chance to speak. "We'll pick you up a few minutes before 6. The gallery is on Meaton. We'll walk, of course. Finding a place to park has become such an ordeal in this town." She could tell from the firm set of Lucille's delicate jaw that she wouldn't take no for an answer. "That sounds lovely. Thank you for the invitation." Ellie spent the rest of the afternoon contemplating the blank canvas on her easel and feeling overwhelmed by her choices of subject matter. This extraordinary city, with its eccentric inhabitants and pungent smells, enamored her, but she found it strange that everything seemed so foreign to her. After all, she'd lived here as a child. Shouldn't she at least have a vague recollection of the area? The park, the waterfront, the marketplace? She took off on foot with her camera slung over her shoulder. She meandered through the vendors at the market until she found an old basket weaver who allowed Ellie to take her picture. In exchange, despite the high price, Ellie purchased an oval-shaped sweetgrass basket from her. Admiring its craftsmanship, she thought she got the better end of the bargain. She snapped photographs of window boxes overflowing with flowers and of horse-drawn carriages packed with tourists. She walked along the waterfront, imagining the sun rising over the harbor, and she strolled through Battery Park, admiring the majestic live oaks. In the end, she decided to start with her garden. More specifically, the view of her garden through her studio window. The breakup with Jake had zapped her creativity. 6 weeks had passed since she last set down her brush and abandoned the piece she'd been working on, a row of houses with vividly painted front doors in Russian Hill. She needed to ease back into her work, to start with a simple project to tune up her skills. First thing in the morning, she would get to work. Ellie deliberated on what to wear for nearly an hour before finally settling on a pair of slim-fitting cropped pants, a hot pink sleeveless silk top, and a pair of gold Tory Burch strappy sandals. Better to be underdressed than overdressed for her first social function in Charleston. At the last minute, she added a tassel necklace in shades of pink, orange, and turquoise, and a tan silk sweater that matched her pants. "You look smashing," Bennett said when she greeted him at the door. Lucille nodded approvingly.
I've always admired a redhead who can pull off that shade of pink.
As she locked the door, Ellie heard Pixie whimpering down the hall in her studio. Her dog seemed content in Maddie's care, but being left alone was stressful for her. Truth be told, Ellie felt the same way. Aside from the two rooms she'd marked as her own, the guest bedroom and her studio, the house felt like a mausoleum. Eleanor Pringle's tomb, with her knick-knacks displayed on every furniture surface, her urn of ashes and position of honor on the mantel, and her restless soul still occupying her bedroom upstairs. As they walked up Church Street toward the gallery, she admired some of the smaller, more charming homes. If she decided to stay in Charleston, wouldn't a house like one of these be better suited for her needs? She dismissed the idea, reminding herself that staying in Charleston was a big if. When Lucille's cell phone rang, she dropped back several paces to accept the call.
You know that all eyes are closely watching this hurricane, Bennett said to Ellie.
She cut a sideways glance at him. What hurricane? I'm afraid I'm out of the loop without a TV.
He gaped at her. Who in this day and age doesn't own a TV?
Ellie smiled. Funny thing is, I didn't realize there was no internet or cable until my flat screen arrived with the moving van on Wednesday. I've called the cable company, but they can't get to me until next week.
Bennett took hold of her elbow, steering her around a sidewalk that had buckled from tree roots.
There's no need to worry about the storm yet. Just be aware of it. It's bearing down on the Caribbean as we speak. There's a cold front making its way across the country. The hope is the cold front will push the hurricane out to sea. If the cold front weakens, though, as several models are predicting it might, the storm could pose a threat to the South Carolina coast. Best thing to do now is stay tuned to the local TV stations for updates, which presents a problem since you don't have a TV.
She removed her phone from her small shoulder bag. I have the weather app on my iPhone. It'll tell me what I need to know.
The Weather Channel is useless in situations like these, Bennett said. Do you have a transistor radio?
Ellie thought about it. But she didn't remember seeing a radio anywhere around the house. Not that I know of, but I'll check with Maddie.
I'll be keeping an eye on the storm, and we'll let you know if we need to make preparations.
They cut over a block to Meeting Street and entered the art gallery. A woman with dark cropped hair and heavily made-up eyes strode toward them like a fashion model making her way down a Paris runway.
Lucille!
She kissed the air beside Lucille's cheek and then offered her hand to Bennett.
I'm so glad you both could make it.
Lucille grabbed Ellie by the elbow.
Felicia, I'd like you to meet my friend Eleanor Pringle. Ellie is an artist as well.
Felicia gave Ellie a quick once-over.
Did you say Pringle? I don't believe I've heard of you.
Ellie flashed Felicia her most brilliant smile, the one she reserved for snooty women.
Oh, but you will. I've only just moved to town.
Bennett drew himself to his full height like a proud papa, and Lucille pressed her lips together to hide her amusement.
Right. I'll be sure to be on the lookout.
Felicia glanced around the crowded room.
I must greet my other guests. Be sure to introduce yourselves to Faye Ryan, the artist. She's floating around here somewhere.
Ellie waited until Felicia was out of earshot before asking, What was all that about?
Felicia fancies herself the darling of contemporary art in this town,
Bennett said in a low voice. Ellie watched the gallery owner mingling with patrons on the other side of the room.
Leave it to me to get off on the wrong foot with the woman who can make or break my career.
Lucille patted her arm.
No need to worry, dear. You handled her well. She has a higher opinion of herself than she deserves. Felicia is at best taken with a grain of salt.
Lucille and Bennett introduced her to so many of their friends
Ellie stopped trying to remember their names. She'd never been good at meeting people. She preferred socializing in more intimate gatherings. She waited until Lucille and Bennett struck up a conversation about the hurricane with a group of their peers before sneaking off to explore the exhibit. She was particularly drawn to an abstract of a tree in bloom. Its branches, with their waxy green leaves and dinner plate-sized cream-colored blooms. She was standing out of the way of the crowd, admiring the painting, when she felt someone's presence behind her. In a gentle, southern drawl, a deep voice asked,
"Are you a fan?"
She glanced back to see a handsome man, about her age, staring down at her. His unusual eyes, more golden than chocolate, the color of cognac, studied her from behind black-rimmed glasses. His lips were curled up in a soft smile that produced a dimple on his right cheek. "Of the artist or the painting?" she asked. He inched closer to her.
"The subject. How do you feel about Southern magnolias?"
Of course. The magnolia tree. How could she have forgotten? A memory of her 5-year-old self curled up at the foot of her mother's bed rushed back to her from out of the blue. Her mother lifted a weak arm and pointed her long finger at the window.
"Be a love and open the window for Mama," she said in a hoarse murmur.
Ellie slid off the bed and padded over to the window in bare feet. She struggled with the window, managing to open it enough for the cool night air to penetrate her mother's stuffy bedroom with the intoxicating aroma of magnolias in bloom. "My grandmother has an enormous tree like that in the back corner of her garden," Ellie said to the man. "I've been trying to remember the name. Magnolias don't grow well in San Francisco, where I'm from."
"I don't imagine they do. They're indigenous to the South."
He stepped in line with her and offered his hand.
Julian Haggard. Welcome to Charleston. Are you in town visiting your grandmother?"
She gave his hand a quick squeeze. "Actually, I live here now in my grandmother's house. She recently passed away. I'm Ellie Pringle."
"That would make you Eleanor Pringle's granddaughter. Our grandmothers were acquaintances. If I'm not mistaken, they were once in the same bridge club. Decades ago, before your grandmother became a recluse. No offense."
"None taken." She turned to face him. "I didn't know my grandmother, but she didn't have any other living relatives, so she left her house to me."
"Try not to sound so excited about it."
"You would understand if you saw the inside of the house. The roof leaks, the walls haven't been painted since before the Civil War, and the same stain is still on the sofa in the living room where I spilled my grape juice 35 years ago." He tilted his head back and laughed.
"You just described 3/4 of the houses on the Battery."
Ellie returned her attention to the magnolia painting. "I can't explain why, but this painting speaks to me."
"Then you should buy it. Prices are reasonable. I've already inquired."
"About this piece?" She held her hand out to the painting. "By all means, if you have first dibs."
"Not about this particular piece."
He removed a folded sheet of paper from the inside pocket of his navy sport coat and handed it to her.
"Here's the price list for all the paintings. I picked it up on the table by the door when I came in."
Her eyes traveled down the price list until she reached the painting titled Sweet Southern Magnolia. Ellie was willing to pay 4 times what the artist was asking for it, but she would keep that information to herself. Voices grew loud and animated from a nearby conversation about the hurricane. "This hurricane is all anyone seems to want to talk about tonight. I've never experienced a hurricane. Should I be worried about it? My grandmother's house is right off the harbor. The water can't come over the sea wall, can it?" An amused expression crossed his face.
"Oh, it definitely can. I've seen it happen many times. but there's no reason for you to worry just yet. These people have nothing better to talk about. Every time a storm comes along, they work themselves into a frenzy. 9 times out of 10, the storm goes out to sea or the damage ends up being minor. Believe me, you'll know when you need to worry. The governor will declare a state of emergency and issue a mandatory evacuation for all low-lying areas. People will board up their houses and place sandbags at their doors. They'll load all their valuable possessions in their cars and join the standstill traffic on I-26. 10 hours later, when they arrive in Columbia, they'll check into a cheap hotel and eat fast food while watching the hurricane coverage on TV. Depending on the extent of the damage from the storm, they'll be stuck in Columbia for days. State and local authorities won't let you back into Charleston until they deem it safe. Hence the reason I never leave town during a hurricane.
Why would anyone put themselves through that?
Because there are plenty of people around here who remember storms like Hurricane Hugo that hit back in 1989, including me. With those kinds of storm surges, you're risking your life when you choose not to evacuate. People with small children would rather be safe than sorry. If that time comes, and that's a very big if, considering we have threats like this at least once every year, you'll have to make the decision that's right for you. Hurricane preparedness is a skill learned through experience. You don't want to stay in your grandmother's big house alone if you've never been through a hurricane before.
Ellie gulped. Thank you, Julian, for your advice. You're quite the authority on hurricanes.
Like I said, I've lived through a few.
She surveyed the room for the Calhouns. It's been a long day. I'm going to purchase this piece and head home. And I pray I'm not driving my painting to Columbia on Monday. He chuckled.
You'll be fine, I promise.
Ellie paid for the magnolia painting and arranged to have it delivered to her grandmother's house the following day. She bid goodnight to the Calhouns, who weren't yet ready to leave, and meandered her way back to South Battery. The sun was sinking toward the horizon, but the air was still thick with humidity. She looked for a familiar face in the people she passed who were out for an evening stroll. When she recognized no one, she reminded herself that this wasn't San Francisco. She missed the cooler weather, the familiar neighborhoods, and the small apartment where she'd lived for more than 10 years. For the first time since she left California, she felt homesick for her artist friends who, after being shut up with their canvases and brushes all day, gathered most evenings for dinner or coffee. Despite the early hour and the grumbling in her tummy, Ellie decided to go to bed early. A thought struck her as she climbed the stairs to the second floor. That's it! Why didn't I think of it before? She entered her mother's bedroom for the first time since the day she'd arrived. She stomped on the random width pine floorboards on both sides of the bed until she felt one give the tiniest bit beneath her foot. Getting down on all fours, she pounded the board loose and peeped inside. In the dark hole where her mother had once stashed her jar of cash, Ellie discovered another one of her journals. As she was replacing the board, she got a whiff of the same rotten stench she'd experienced on her first day in Charleston. Journal in hand, she hurried out of the room, careful to close the door tight behind her.
Chapter 8. Ashton. My modeling career took off like a racehorse out of the starting gate, and I owe my instant success to Abbott. He took a special interest in me. Olga Porter admitted to me once that she would never have agreed to represent me if not for him. Abbott is one of the most sought-after photographers in New York. He's offered the best gigs, and he requests that I be his model for those gigs. 3 years have passed since I left home, since I last spoke with my mother. I don't expect to hear from her. In fact,
I pray I won't hear from her. Regardless, I send her boxes of lavish gifts every Christmas. Silk Hermes scarves and an ultra suede coat designed by Halston. Items I know she'll never wear. They are symbols of my success. Representations of my life of high fashion. I hope she gets my message. I'm living my dream. The dream I've made come true all on my own. I won't stay on top of my game forever. Girls 10 years younger than I, with bodies not yet fully developed, are making their way onto the scene. I'm considering moving out to Hollywood and auditioning for the movies. I know nothing about acting, about as much as I knew about modeling when I first came to New York. Transitioning from modeling to acting seems like a logical career move. I can see myself starring in serious roles for mature leading ladies like Faye Dunaway. For the past month, Abbott has been working in Hollywood on a series for Vogue. He speaks of warm, fragrant nights and palm trees rustling in the breeze. He wants to have a serious conversation about our future next week when he gets home. I've pressed him, but he refuses to say more until we talk in person. Neither of us is ready to make a lifetime commitment. We've talked about marriage a time or two, but we've agreed to wait. We are in our prime. We need to get as much out of our careers as we can while we can. I'm certainly not interested in starting a family anytime soon. Pregnancy and childbirth will ruin my figure and bring my career to an abrupt halt. A year ago, Louisa and I moved to a larger 2-bedroom apartment on a safer, more prominent street in the village. Louisa has given up on becoming a model and is focusing on her career at the ad agency. Turns out she has a talent for copywriting. She's been put up for a promotion. I hope she gets it. It would take some of the pressure off me. Louisa tries hard not to let it show, but I know she resents my success. Abbott thinks it's creepy the way she tries to emulate me, but I'm flattered by the attention. What harm is there in Louisa wearing the same shade of lipstick as me, even if the color is all wrong for her skin tone? What bothers me more is the way she constantly flirts with Abbott. He makes dreams come true for girls like us. He turns them into superstars. And I get the impression she would choose him over me in a heartbeat, if given the chance. The stomach flu or whatever it is that has been making me feel puny for a week finally caught up with me yesterday, and I had to call in sick from an important gig. I hope I feel better tomorrow. Louisa pounded on the door this morning a few minutes before 8. Nettie, are you alive in there? She entered the room without waiting for a response. She gasped when she saw me curled into a fetal position on my queen-size bed. Your face is as green as split-pea soup. Please. My hand shot out from beneath the blanket. Don't talk about food. Especially food as gross as split-pea soup. Whatever this is, I can't seem to shake it. Louisa pressed the back of her hand against my forehead. You don't have any fever. If I didn't know any better, I might think you're pregnant. But you do know better, I said, without lifting my head off the pillow. You're the one who insisted I see your gynecologist. Louisa reminded me that diaphragms aren't foolproof and left the room. She returned a minute later with a plastic sleeve of saltines, a can of ginger ale, and the New York Times. Are you going to call in sick again? I drew my legs even closer to my body. I hope not. We'll see how the day goes. I don't have to be at work until this afternoon. We're doing an evening shoot in Central Park. Call me at work if you need anything, she said, and sashayed her ample hips out of the room. My roommate stopped caring about her weight when she abandoned her dream of becoming a model. A pity, too. She has such a pretty face. I rolled over on my back and reached for the sleeve of crackers. When was the last time I had my period? 3 months ago? Maybe 4? I stopped keeping track of my cycle a long time ago. An extra pound on the body is like 10 on the camera. I starve myself to the point of malnourishment, which in turn affects my menstruation. At least I don't make myself vomit like so many of the other girls. The more I lay there thinking about vomiting, the more it seemed like a good idea. I yanked back the covers, sending the New York Times